The Tom Woods Show, episode 1905.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here. Michael Malice is back on the show today, and I'm sure you know Michael Malice. He is a very successful celebrity ghostwriter and a successful author in his own right. And of course, he's the host of You're Welcome with Michael Malice, his great podcast. What I want to talk about today is his brand new book, The Anarchist Handbook, which has spent several days as the number one nonfiction book on all of Amazon, which is an astonishing achievement. And really, as two people who have been involved in book publishing for a very long time, we're going to talk today about just this phenomenon. This defies every expectation, every strategy that a consultant would give you with regard to promoting a book and having success with it. It's an amazing feat. And as I say, it defies all expectations. So this is going to be an episode where we get into that aspect of things. And then in the future, we'll have episodes where we talk about the content of the book. Now, in case I have some listeners who are scandalized by the subject matter, who say, well, I'm not against government per se. I just want government kept within certain limits and just keep it confined to the Constitution and all that. Okay, I mean, I'm not going to spend the rest of my life arguing with you about that. I used to hold that view also. And we can still be friends if we have a difference of opinion on that. But by and large, the kind of anarchism we're talking about is not the left-wing property is theft style of anarchism, but rather the free market version, which says, we don't need a state because the market provides everything in a superior way. And if that seems like it's a little bit too much for you to take, well, just think of it this way. Think of the COVID fiasco, where the state is constantly assuring us we couldn't live without it. We couldn't survive without its expert guidance and all this and that. Where would we be and blah, blah, blah. But we all know this is nonsense. We all know it's all been propaganda. It's done enormous damage. We would have been vastly better off without any of it. Well, now extend that. Consider the possibility that that reasoning applies across the board. We all know that the private sector creates shoes better than the government would, and produces a whole variety of goods better than the government would. The government provides most of the education in the United States, and that's in the toilet. And we all know that the legal system, what, you sue somebody and it takes 58 years and $8 billion for you to have your case heard. Everything the thing touches turns to rust, everything it touches. So the question is, might it be that the same people who assure us that where would you be without our legal services and where would you be without this and that, these are the same people as the COVID people, right? It's the same kind of thinking. It's the same kind of attitude. What if actually maybe we could be okay without these things? Maybe we don't need Nancy Pelosi for anything. Maybe it's not just that, well, we just wish Nancy Pelosi would confine herself to what? The most important tasks in all of society, which is what the limited government argument is, that we just need government to take care of the most important things of all. I don't know. It seems utopian to me to think that an institution like that would ever be kept limited. What if we think about alternative ways of approaching social organization? What if we take the insights we get from the market economy and extend them even into areas where we've never thought about it before? After what we've gone through in 2020, I would say it's about time to be willing to think in different ways. If not now, then when? Anyway, I'm not trying right now to convince you one way or the other, but just at least to keep an open mind and be willing to entertain ideas maybe you wouldn't have considered in 2019. But, well, frankly, after what we've been through, what choice have you got? Anyway, Michael Malice, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Tom.
I don't know what in the world is going on. I don't know what to make of this. But when you told me, I'm going to put together this thing, the Anarchist Handbook, and it's going to have contributions from all these people. And, you know, these are people who are by and large dead. These are important pieces, essays from over the years, explicating various aspects and strains of anarchism. I thought that actually sounds like a really, really good idea. And I was thinking, you know, this could be a good premium to give away to supporters. I mean, so I was going kind of into marketing mode. And oh, and just to show how absolutely fallible I am, I have you on here to talk about how it actually turned out and how I so lowballed it, and I would have played this all wrong with my strategy, because I don't know. I don't want to steal your thunder. What can you just tell people what happened? Because it's, I don't know what world we're living in.
I don't either. One of the things that is of use to people in general is when they have a project or product that works or doesn't work. I was a business major, as you probably know. You want to reverse engineer what happened so you can replicate it or improve it or fix it. I have no theories as to what happened. What happened was I put together the Anarchist Handbook because for a very long time, when you know what happens when you when your career develops, you're still the same person. So it's very hard mentally to keep up with where you are because you're still that same guy as 5 years ago. One of my first like fitness coaches used to be fat in high school. And in his mind, he's still like a fat person, which I will always remind him about every opportunity I have. So when I first started doing a lot of television, my mantra was, no one cares about what you have to say. So say something interesting or say something uninteresting in an interesting way. That was my goal and approach. And it seemed to have worked to some extent. After a while, everyone kept bugging me about anarchism and like, how would this work? How would that work? How did that work? And I'm like, why am I, and I say this quite ironically, why am I the authority on anarchism? So there was a book that was written in the, compiled rather in the 60s, I believe, called Patterns of Anarchy, which was a collection of historical essays. It was a paperback and it's pretty hard to find. As a book collector, when you get a paperback, I want it to have no creases in the spine, so it displays really nice. And this one is like 600 pages, so like finding one at all and finding one with the uncreased spine is just almost impossible, whatever. So Marla, who's one of my supporters at malice.locals.com, I was doing a live stream, and she said, well, why don't you do an audiobook of this? And I'm like, oh, you know, that's a good idea to bring it into the mainstream. And then I'm like, well, wait a minute. This is public domain. Why don't I do my version of it? Because a lot of these essays I don't think are really applicable. Plus, I want to include the ANCAPs and things like that. I also want to, you know, as someone who's a collector in general, the mark of a good collection at base is that it's comprehensive, right? Or somewhat comprehensive. So I'm like, okay, let me make sure I have all the big names represented of anarchism. And there were some essays that were not in public domain, and I reached out to those people, and they all gladly gave permission. David Friedman, John Hasnas, who wrote what I consider to be probably the best anarchist essay about the, you know, the myth of objective law. Mm-hmm. I reached out to Jeff Deist from Mises for permission to use Rothbard, which he gladly gave. And the Tannehills, who had written The Market for Liberty, which was like the first ANCAP book, even though they don't use the word anarchism in it. Those rights were held by Laissez-Faire Books, which got bought out by Agora Publishing. And the thing is, when you're doing a book on Amazon that you're publishing yourself, it's difficult because what happens is you upload the file and they go, great, we're going to look this over. And the thing is, you uploaded the ebook and the trade paperback, and then they go on separate tracks with it within Amazon. And then for one of them, they're like, all right, a lot of this looks like it's previously been published, we don't know that you have the rights to publish it, which is very valid. So then I gave them a list of everyone's death dates and copyrights, and they go, well, we need more information. And in between each of these, you have like 3 days. You know what I mean? Like it's a bureaucracy. They're taking their time. So you can't really set a release date, but I'll get to that in a second. Then they're like, well, you don't have the rights to this because Anatomy of the State is already a book. Then they're like, well, you don't have the rights to this because, you know, Jeff gave the Deist gave the permissions to a different email than the one that you are emailing us from. And I'm like, okay. So then one day they're like, okay, it's approved. So I had been in LA last week and I did 5 shows and I didn't even bring it up because not only did I not know when it was going to be approved, my Soviet brain and dealing with publishing as a rule told me that something's going to happen and it's going to get pulled. Like they're just going to, you know, they're going to be like, oh, you can't write this. You can't include Bakunin in here. Who do you think you are? And they approved it. And I'm like, all right, it's out. And then over the weekend for a full day, it's still in the top 10. It was the most popular nonfiction book in America. And it was number three in general. It was Dr. Seuss was number one, a novel by someone named Laura Dave, I don't know who she is, more power to her, was number two. The Anarchist Handbook was number three. Meaning I was beating literally everyone, including Obama, Oprah, minor figures like this, every writer you've ever heard of. And I'm sitting there, and it would be one thing if this was like a 1 hour spike. I'm sure most people listening have some working knowledge of statistics. It's not that hard. Like if you look at the chart of people dead as a result of terrorism, right? And you have the window between 1990 and 2020, you're going to have that big spike in 2001, you know, for obvious reasons. So it's not that hard to be like, okay, maybe everyone bought it during this 1 hour. The Amazon bestseller list updates hourly, but then it's going to return to Earth an hour later. That has not been the case. It's been several days now that it's selling phenomenally well. And I have a few theories. None of the theories explain why it's at the level it is at all. I have no understanding or even hypothesis. A lot of people have to give me reasons why it would do well. Sure. No one has put together a cogent reason why it would do better than everyone. So I am ecstatic and delighted. One of the things that I've been spending a lot of time on in the last year and a half is, you know, the white pill, the concept of hope. And to have data that is incontrovertible to demonstrate that the good guys can win, I am delighted, I'm sure, is going to be very exciting and validating for a lot of people, because people do want hope. They want, okay, you're saying this can happen. Show me, you know, like I want to believe you. And it's like, here you go. And it's like, oh, okay. Maybe this guy knows what he's talking about to some extent.
I want to make sure everybody understands that when I say something like, I have no idea how this is possible. And when you say that, this is not a put down of Michael in any way. No. It's that we both have experience as authors in one capacity or another, and goes back many years. And this particular book release bears no resemblance to the book release of any successful book we're aware of. And incidentally, on the other side of the coin, there are some books. So you had no publisher behind you, no marketing department, no publicity, no launch, no book launch. It just, you know, you just said, hey, this thing's out there, and it just took off. But by contrast, there are some books. Now, I know you could make an easy joke here, but there are some books where all the marketing in the world wouldn't sell them. And I'm thinking of Max Boot's book. Max Boot wrote a book about how he left conservatism because they weren't good enough for him and all that. Nobody wants to read that. Not anyone wants to read that. He got every single major morning talk show. Everybody interviewed him about this. And it's all over the major newspapers and everything. And that book bombed. It didn't go anywhere. And with none of that, nothing. And without the, you know, obviously Max Boot has establishment support and all that. Somehow you made this happen. We're all cheering. All of us who are equally bewildered at this are all cheering, because this beats the hell out of the GameStop thing. Like, this is in your face, one person with an idea standing up against everybody who has all these other advantages. And by the way, you have published with a major publisher before, so it's not like you couldn't get one. It's that you just decided to do it this way, and man, did it pay off.
I've made more now in this 5 days than I have with the entirety of the new right. Because when you do a book yourself, you get six times the royalties per copy than you do with the publisher. Six times.
Yeah, it's unbelievable.
So I just had to do a sixth of the advance in order to earn, and I have. And let me check right now as we record to tell you exactly where we are in terms of the Amazon ratings. Oh, it's at zero. No. let me see. As we record right now, it is the number, drum roll please, number eight book in all of Amazon.
That includes fiction, which is what most people read. That includes cookbooks. That's everything.
Let's go through it, okay? And the thing is, this has happened since we're recording right now on Tuesday. It hit number three on Sunday, and this list is dynamic. It updates hourly. So let me go through the top 10. Number one, as I said earlier, is Dr. Seuss. Great. Number two is Laura Dave, that novel. Mark Levin, he's previously hit number one. His book on American Marxism is number three. More power to him, Mazel Tov. Behold a Pale Horse. I don't know what this is. It's at number four. It's got 7,000 reviews. It came out in 1991. So this is an evergreen.
Yeah.
This is about UFOs. Okay. This is, you can see why it's a big deal. Yeah. The Four Agreements is number five. A Practical Guide to Personal Freedom. What is this? Is this some kind of self-help thing?
I don't know. Okay. Yeah.
This is some self-help thing. Self-help things do, by the way, for people's edification, self-help books sell so much more successfully than other nonfiction books that the New York Times had to give them their all category, or else the entire New York Times bestseller list would be self-help.
Yeah.
Just right. So people understand this.
Right.
The Midnight Library by Matt Haig is a novel. That's at number six.
And then number seven, you have another self-help book.
Is Atomic Habits and Then Me. Then number 10 is Oprah. Yeah, Stacey Abrams is 12. Everyone listening to this, everyone, loves The Very Hungry Caterpillar by Eric Carle. You read it as a kid. It's number 15. Bill O'Reilly is 23. Matthew McConaughey is 27. The 48 Laws of Power, 33. Seth Rogen, 31. Thomas Sowell's biography, 38. I'm just looking. Dale Carnegie, heard of that random loser? He's at 43. Okay. But that's what's really funny. By the way, like Eric Weinstein and Justin Amash both independently had asked me like why you'd want to intentionally alienate people. And it's like, well, look, you could do the Dale Carnegie thing and be at 43. Or you could do the Michael Malice thing and be number eight.
Yeah, exactly right.
So the data's telling me I'm doing something. So the data is telling me I'm doing something right. You and I do not know what that thing is. And this is not modesty. This is a major accomplishment that I don't understand.
Yeah, yeah.
But by the way, there's two things that are really moving for me about this accomplishment. One is, I want to get this quote exactly right. Lewis Ling is on the cover of the book. We'll talk about him in a second. He was one of the Chicago anarchists who were basically turned into martyrs and hanged for their views. And August Spee's last words were on the monument dedicated to them. And he said, "The day will come when our silence will be more powerful than the voices you're strangling today." Well, I made that happen. It took them a long time. They were killed in the late 1880s. But now their voices are being much louder than they were 130 years ago. That's number one. Number two, part of this was because The White Pill, the other book I'm working on, is taking so long. And a big chunk of The White Pill, spoiler alert, is going to be dedicated to all the atrocities that were done under communism. So to now have proof or very strong evidence that there is going to be a wide audience who are going to bear witness to what had been done to all these literally millions of people, as well as certain specific individual stories that I'll be telling, really is just very moving to know that, you know, people are going to read this and be like, holy crap, I didn't know any of this. And just how like demonic and barbaric it was for these people who are my countrymen. You know, this is what my family escaped.
Well, I'm very much looking forward to that. And if you hadn't had this project, I would even ask you, do you know when you're going to have that ready? But I don't know. We'll talk about that another time. I want to stay focused on this. At some point in selling a book, if you start to have some success, as you did with this, it becomes like an event that people want to be part of. People who might have been sympathetic to the book, but
the
they
bandwagon
figure,
effect.
I have a lot of books to read, you know, and I'm sure Malice's book is good, but I just have so much going on. But then it gets to a level, and I don't know what that level is, where people say, well, I need to be part of this. I need to have a copy. Yeah. So when I posted about your success on Facebook, I had somebody say, all right, you convinced me. I need to have one. Now, I didn't say anything about the merits of the book or what was inside or anything. The entirety of the convincing was Malice is killing everybody right now in the publishing world. And that was what made the person say, I need to have this book.
Well, I think in our circles that we swim in, first of all, it's not a random sample, right? To be put it mildly, if you're dealing with some kind of radical ideology, it's going to attract a certain type of personality or a certain type of mindset. And I think one of the things it attracts is A, people who love the independent creator.
Yeah.
And people love this sense of upending the establishment. And people love when someone who they have a tangential connection to, or someone that they have some vague fondness for, is making it succeed. So it's kind of like, you know, it's kind of like buying a wedding present. It's like, let me share in your joy. And I feel this way all the time. Like if a friend of mine has an album out, I'll buy the album. I would say I would buy your eBooks, but they're free.
Yep.
So it's, I can't really help you there, but who can? But it's I get that mindset a lot. The point is, for every person you and I have who feels that way, Barack Obama and Oprah have literally 1,000 people who would jump in front of a bus for them. So it still doesn't explain the situation.
No, oh no, it doesn't. It's a small piece.
Yeah. So
it's a small piece.
I am all the people putting up photos of them with the book. There were people with their kids with the book. Someone went to the actual Haymarket Martyrs Monument with their daughter and took photos of her and was talking about Louis Ling. I just feel, you know, these were, by the way, these were radical anarchists, communists who wanted a violent revolution. But to be able to, and I don't know that they would approve of my lifestyle, worldview, whatever. But the fact that I can, and this is part of the hipster brain of mine, the fact that people who really were passionate and intense and stood for something, the fact that I could kind of take a little bit out of the wastebasket of history and give them some time in the spotlight for their accomplishments is something I am very, very honored to be in a position to be. And there's just something else, which is Dave Smith, who some of your listeners might know, he's a very failed presidential candidate. He was the one who told me, and I didn't even realize this. You know, sometimes it's something so obvious that you have to have somebody else tell you. He's like, you're the guy who's going to get a lot of people to read Lysander Spooner and Anatomy of the State. And, you know, Lysander Spooner was the one that brought you over, Tom, and many other such cases. Yeah, Anatomy of the State, I don't need to tell the listeners what a you know, phenomenal accomplishment that is.
By the way, not everybody was going to know that's an essay by Murray Rothbard that everybody needs to read.
Yeah, it's in the entirety is in there, but that's the one that really, I think, it brought Dave over. So both the essay that convinced Dave and the essay that convinced you are in here. So who knows how many Tom's Woods and Dave Smith I'm making with this collection.
I just want to say for the record.
I just want one more thing, yeah. You know, to have anarchism be part of the Overton window and to have it be destigmatized and part of the discussion is such a huge, this is something we've all been fighting for a very long time.
And I had no idea that this would break through like this, obviously, so spectacularly. It wouldn't occur to anybody.
You know what? Someone else, just one more thing. Some people are like, oh, this was great because this is something people are hungry and excited for. I'm sorry. That doesn't take you to like number one.
No, again, it is.
It'd be one thing if there was a book on COVID, right? Or a book on Cuomo, Trump. These are all these things I can wrap my head around. But there's no TV specials in anarchism. There's no like hot podcast series, you know, like, you know, history of anarchism. So I agree, obviously, people are hungry for it to a point, but it's not the number one issue in America.
No, it's not. Hey, everybody, I want to take a minute to thank our sponsor, Merck Investments. I sense a lot of frustration among some of our folks that in our circles, we hear a lot of talk that there is always an imminent stock market crash. And then we just keep hearing this over and over and over. And sometimes that's right, but it's not always right. And our friends at Merck Research are trying to provide unbiased monthly analysis on the economy and stock market. And through a consistent set of easy-to-read charts and frameworks with written analysis, you'll get through these monthly reports an intellectually consistent view on the market and economy that is not just doom and gloom. So you can download the PDF chart books with analysis or watch the video voiceover walkthrough. And their goal is just to help you better understand what's really going on and ultimately to help you make better investment decisions. So much financial media has become fear-mongering clickbait. And indeed, in the long run, maybe there is bad news, but that does not mean that in every short-run segment, it's always bad. So if you're tired of nonstop doom and gloom and you want an objective, insightful summary of what's going on in the market and economy, go over to tomwoods.com/research for a no-risk 3-month free trial. And it's only $20 a month after that. That's tomwoods.com/research. Now, you surpassed me because back in 2004.
That's not saying much.
Yeah, and that's why I delayed this point for later in the episode.
Tell me something I don't know.
Yeah, but when the Politically Incorrect Guide to American History came out, that was 2004. And I got to number 6 overall, but I did it the traditional way. We had a launch. I was on Fox News a couple of times. In the old days, Joe Scarborough had a show called Scarborough Country, and Pat Buchanan would fill in sometimes. He had me on for 2 segments. And that book stayed in the top 100 for 3 months, and it did really well. But it was, okay, I was really happy and I didn't expect that. But the extent to which I didn't expect that is a different dimension from we didn't expect this in your case because of how unorthodox the situation is. And then secondly, I guess the thing I want to say is back in 2004, yeah, some people read my articles here and there online, but I didn't have like a following. I didn't have a fan base or anything like that. So I was selling those books to people who saw it on television and stuff like that. I kind of wish I'd been able to do that book now when I have a, you know, I have big following on the social media platforms. I have people who listen to me every day. I have a big email list. That would be more fun because I want to sell, I want people who kind of like and appreciate what I'm doing to be part of this excitement of, hey, look at the book's doing this well, this well. I wasn't able to share that with people. And it's so thrilling to me to watch you, particularly on Twitter, have so many people say, I just got my copy and I'm so excited about this and I'm so pumped for you and it's so great that you're able to share that with the community you've built.
Yeah, they're, you know what it's like for them is what I'm being told. It's like if you got into Bitcoin early and then it's just blowing up, it's like, yeah, they invested in Malice Coin at an early point. Yes. And now they get to be the ones. And I, as again, as I said earlier, as a hipster, I revel in being like, oh, I was into that band 3 years ago. It's pretty cool that you like them now. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But there is a lot to be said for something I feel that very frequently when it's something that I am a fan of. It's like my personal discovery. And then it goes wide. It's like, hell yeah. Like I'm onto something.
Another thing I want to point out, now this is not related to the book, but you don't have like any huge foundation money behind you. There's no giant institution pushing you all the time. I mean, the right wing, broadly defined, has its different foundations. And if one of their people comes out with a book, well, they're just all over the place pushing the heck out of that thing. You don't have that. I don't have that. And yet what you've done is very, very interesting and impressive to me because you're completely self-made, in other words. Like your presence in the conversation and on social media and on television is due entirely to your own merits, not through because of mass promotion that you got from some billionaire institution or nothing like that. And you've done it in a way that is absolutely unique and irreplaceable. Like, for example, I was just watching your most recent appearance on Dave Rubin, and you came out and he laughed because of the way you were dressed, your presentation. You're one of the only people who can pull that off. And you've gotten to a point where you deliver so consistently that you can say to a guy like Rubin, you can say to his team, now listen, Dave can't see me until I walk out onto the set. And they all just say, okay, yeah, Malice is making a request. We're going to honor it. Or at the Mises Institute, you were the mystery speaker. And you said to the president of the Mises Institute, all right, this is an envelope containing a letter. I need you to read that letter to the audience before I come out. But you cannot have read the letter in advance. You have to be reading it for the first time when you're reading it to the audience. And Jeff Dice just said, yeah, okay, I'll do that. You know, I have to tell you, not a lot of people could get places like that to do that. But because you consistently deliver, they know there's a point to it. They enjoy being a part of it. No one else has done that. You've been completely unique and you've done it entirely on the basis of your own merits. And if this sounds like I'm, you know, over the top bromance kind of thing, it doesn't matter. These are facts and it thrills me that you've been so successful with it.
Here's another fact. The definition of red pill, as I have it in my book, and I think most people subscribe to this definition, is that what is presented as fact by the corporate press is in actuality a carefully constructed narrative designed to keep some very unpleasant people in power, right? As we record, Reason still has not in any way acknowledged that this has happened. They're simply pretending it didn't happen. And I've tagged them on Twitter in one tweet so they know. And I am, honestly, I'm quite surprised. I'm quite surprised. And it is also giving me some very unfortunate data.
That is unfortunate. And frankly, anybody in our tradition, and there we have some limited government minarchist people who still appreciate, you can still appreciate Lysander Spooner. You can still love Murray Rothbard. I did when I was a minarchist. All of them should be impressed by this, celebrating it, and considering a good thing, and at least tweeting it out or whatever. I don't get why any institution or person of prominence in this thing would not be doing that. And I'm saying that even to my own people. Like, this is stupid and silly and petty. This is an unbelievable achievement, and it's ridiculous not to celebrate it.
Or it's perfectly fine to condemn it. I mean, but to pretend it didn't happen when, you know, oh, some Libertarian Party member got elected to the city council in Wyoming, I think that's, is, to me, dishonest.
So you initially, I think, conceived of this as being something that a quick project you could turn around between the moment you thought of it and the release of.
I didn't even think of it.
Yeah.
Conceived in liberty, you might call it.
Yes, right. But it was like a, you know, it's something quick you could do that would maybe, I don't know, tide people over till your book comes out. And then it turned out, this turned out to be the thing.
I am cautiously optimistic about the impact the white pill is going to have.
Are you self-publishing that? I already know the answer, but...
Of course.
Yeah.
Of course. If I talked to my agent today, I was wrong because I had said on my locals, malice.locals.com, my community, that I didn't think I could get a book deal for this. My agent says I think I could have sold it. My agent's a kind of a big shot. He's a very big shot. But the thing is, if he did sell it, it would be out in 2023.
Right. And you're talking about the white pill?
No, I'm talking about the anarchist handbook.
Yeah, no, see, here's the thing. The conventional wisdom is that anthologies just don't sell. So I've had an agent tell me, what I did a collection of anti-war writings, and he said, no, I don't want to, I'll pass on that because anthologies don't sell. And I think probably 98% of the time he's right. But I
90% of books don't sell.
Yeah, that's an excellent point.
Let's be honest, you know? Yeah.
Yeah. Overwhelmingly nonfiction books
don't sell. No, nonfiction sells better than a fiction. When a novel dies, it's really DOA. With nonfiction, you're often going to at least get that person's personal audience, so they'll at least sell 1,000 copies or something.
Yeah,
like
that's
true.
Yeah, yeah. But I think for the average listener right now hearing you say, well, at least they'll sell 1,000 copies, they're thinking that is catastrophic.
Right.
Because I think a lot of people think if you're an author, your book, you know, it's at least going to sell 15,000. No, it does not work that way. Or they think when I had Meltdown on the bestseller list, I had people saying, this is so exciting that millions and millions of people are going to be reading a book about the Federal Reserve. Nope, that is not how nonfiction bestsellers work. Sorry.
Right.
So I don't know you're going to do an audiobook of this.
Yes, sir.
Read by you, which
I
think people would love to have.
I'm actually now toying with the idea of having a bunch of my friends read a different chapter.
Oh, now that's also not a bad idea. You got to make sure all your friends have decent audio quality, which is...
I don't have friends who don't have decent audio quality.
Okay, good.
I meant blue checks and you and Dave.
Yeah. Okay, good. Yeah, that's not a bad idea either. Jeez, you're smart.
Right? Like, wouldn't it be great to, like, just as a troll, as someone who loves the... I don't want to say troll is not the right word in this context. As someone who's an admirer of the absurd, to have Dave Rubin reading Emma Goldman.
Yeah, no, I love it.
There's something so beautifully surreal about that. And I got to tell you, I made sure to include the early anarchists, the left anarchists, the communist anarchists very heavily. A, so that ANCAPs could get an idea of the tradition. But B, so that all those left anarchists who despise Rothbard and think it's a perversion of anarchism, they can't complain to me that I'm not giving their people a fair shot and they're not being represented or they're being treated disrespectfully. They're all Proudhon's in there, Kropotkin's in there, Bakunin's in there, Emma Goldman, who I love, Berkman, who's actually a better writer than her, who's an attempted assassin. They're all in there. Even if you disagree, they're represented. So you and I have talked about this many times in the past. Like, a lot of these ANCAPs who think that the left anarchists don't have a right to the term, it drives me absolutely crazy. And it's just excruciatingly embarrassing when they say things like this. So they're all in there. And it's just interesting because a lot of ANCAPs, people in the Rothbard or David Friedman tradition, you know, often ask, like, how did these anarcho-communists, how do they account for A, B, and C? And you could read it for yourself. I don't find that their answers are particularly edifying, but I'm letting them speak for themselves, you know what I mean, without editorializing.
Yeah. And I think that's valuable for everybody on all sides. So it's a great project, but beyond the greatness, and so you notice that this was kind of a meta episode because we didn't get into much detail about the content itself. We're going to do that in the future. Get Michael back and we'll really dive into this thing.
But the thing is, Tom, just sorry to interrupt you. One of the reasons I wrote this book, there's a concept in publishing called Evergreen, which is just like The Hungry Caterpillar, a book that just sells constantly for year after year. I did not expect this to sell huge, but I knew this book would be just as relevant and I wouldn't have to change a word probably in 2025 as now. So that this would be the go-to resource if you want to know about this tradition, which has a long and proud history and maybe sometimes not so proud. It'll be there on the shelf for you whenever you like. And that has happened now. So it's great.
Now, the traditional drawback to that is that in the old days, when in order to publicize a book, you had to get on TV, you had to get on major radio, whatever, they need a news hook. Just the fact that Michael Malice has a new book out is not enough to get you on there. So the problem with an evergreen book is that the news hook is not always as clear as if I wrote a book about critical race theory or COVID or Dr. Fauci or something like that. But with this book, you didn't need television. So that was not even a problem.
The other thing I'm very, very proud of with the book is, you know, one of the things I talk about in the new right, and Thaddeus Russell discusses this in his book to some extent, and you and I have talked about this, and it almost feels like you can't really wrap your head around it because you're much more of a square than me, and I'm not saying that in a pejorative sense, just like we're just wired differently, is like my thesis about how culture is created, meaning it's made on the margins and the fringes, then you have the proselytizers, then corporate America, you know, consumes it and excretes it in a manner that the layman can appreciate. And the cover I did with my buddy John Gerges, who's probably like the most talented person I know. He's also done my theme song. He did the cover for Dear Reader. It was something called Vaporwave, which is an internet kind of style. It's like Miami 1987, basically, is the look. And this is the kind of thing that was cool on the internet maybe 4 or 5 years ago. But I knew if it was something that was cool on the internet 4 or 5 years ago, this is something corporate America hasn't gotten to yet. So for people who are used to looking in bookstores, this is something they would not have seen. It hasn't jumped over yet. So I'm glad that I get to be a cover that no corporate publisher would ever do, or at least wouldn't do for another few years.
Right. The book, of course, as we've said numerous times, The Anarchist Handbook. I'm going to link to it at tomwoods.com.
Anarchisthandbook.com. Very easy to remember.
Oh, even better. I'll link to that also.
I'm no dummy. I learned from Tom. Get the URL.
Yes, you're darn right. I love that. I love that that was available. I'll have it also at tomwoods.com/1905, where I'll have the link to your locals and all the other Michael Malice stuff, because people should be following you on Twitter and stuff like that.
And so, I got to say one more thing, my locals, I'm going to make a pitch for it because you have your supporting listeners group and this is an audience that would accept to it. How it works is the community is free. If you want to, it's like a mix of Facebook and Patreon. If you want to support me for $5 a month, you get to comment and read the exclusive content. And this is what allows me to do books like this, that I don't have to worry about being canceled or being homeless. So there's like 20,000 people there already, over 2,000 who are supporters. Any support is very much appreciated and not at all expected. But it's this is the kind of thing where people are like, how can I help you, you know, promote this? This is the way to do it.
Excellent. I just love it. I just love it. So check out all these links. And also, of course, make sure and join me for the 2000th episode of the Tom Woods Show, because Michael will be there also, October 16th,
TomWoods2000.com.
Oh, let's hear it.
You have no idea. I'm not making any pitch. I'm telling you, Tom, and the audience gets to listen in. I've told this to you before. I'm telling to you again. You have no idea what's coming, and I intend to blow everyone out of the water. Literally, there's going to be torpedoes.
All right, look, you guys have to be there. You know you want to go. You know it's going to be great. It doesn't cost you anything to attend. I have had officially now 2 extremely successful marketers tell me that that's a dumb mistake, that I should have charged people. But I say they're the dumb mistake, that honestly, I know what I'm doing. It's much better to have this be free. But you need to register. So tomwoods2000.com is the site. Not tomwoods.com/2000. tomwoods2000.com is the site where you
can
register.
Say something else?
Yeah, please.
I've been having imaginary arguments with your audience already. So let me nip something in the bud. When we do this, if you and I do a Q&A, I don't know how much of a big shot I'll be by then. Do not get on that mic and ask me to unblock you from Twitter, because all that's going to happen is me humiliating you in front of the room, and not in a way that's going to be humorous to you.
Okay. And also, I guess people should know, I'm not like the secret portal to getting you back into Michael's, you know, getting you
and on the board. I already imagined sitting down with whoever you have running the mics and telling them in writing, it is your job to make sure you do not let go of that mic, because I do not want that argument with that rando crazy person holding the mic and then it's a discussion.
Yeah, no, we're not doing anything like that. So you don't have to worry. It's just going to be fun. And you and I have to talk logistics, but we'll do that off the air.
Yes.
Congratulations on the great success you've had.
Thank you, Tom. I could have done it without you.
Shut up. All right, folks, that's going to do it for today. Now, if you haven't yet seen my website with all the COVID charts and you have to decide without having them labeled, which state being depicted on this chart is the one with the greater lockdown or whatever, the whole point of this quiz is to show people that these measures don't seem to have done certainly enough for to show up on the graphs, that's for sure. It's a quiz that it's designed for you to fail it, because you have to pick out which places engaged in which alleged mitigation measures. And as you can see, there's really no way to tell, which is kind of the point. So the website is COVIDCharts with an S, COVIDChartsQuiz.com. So go enjoy that, and I'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at Podsworth.com.